ages I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bay.
You're listening to episode 649 of Unwelcome Guests. Why Money Will End and How to Prepare. I'm Robin Upton, and I have a special show for you this week. I'm going to be collecting my thoughts over a decade of reflections on the money system. And this has an accompanying slideshow, so if you're listening online, you probably want to go to this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/649, and download that. There's a table of contents linking in this presentation. If you're listening on the radio, no matter, I shall paint a picture with words and do my best to get my point across without the visual aid. I won't explicitly reference the different slides, so you should be able to follow fairly easily. It's in two parts. First part, why money will end. I'm going to start by emphasizing that money has a story attached to it. The public story of money is a very important point because it justifies our use of money. It explains what money is to newcomers, and I shall point out it abridges some very important moral choices, but this is the public story of money. It's familiar to most everybody who uses money. First of all, money is a medium of exchange. It's a safe store of value. It's a measure of productivity. It's independent of political and legal systems. The public story, the way that it's always been taught in economics departments, is that, no, it's just a separate entity. It's taught as if it arose naturally from barter. Now, if you're in any doubt as to whether money did in fact arrive from barter, I recommend episode 577 of this radio show, The Rothschild Formula and the Myth of Barter, and sort of the corollary of those 5 points, never really explicitly stated, is that money is essential for prosperity, perhaps even for survival in the modern world. Now, a little bit on linguist and political scientist George Lakoff's strict father morality. This is drawing from episode 505. Now, if you look on the slide, you'll see a web reference. A lot of the slides have got these links in the top right. So if you're interested, do click on that link. That should take you to some further details, some original sources, some people who can explain it in more depth and clarity than I've done in this presentation. And George Lakoff explains that the very influential view of how to bring up children, which he calls the strict father model, posits various assumptions that father is right and has to get his correct values across to his children. How should he do that? Some sort of behavioral operant conditioning. So, where children deviate, he should punish them painfully. Last episode, we heard a little bit about spanking and possible consequences thereof. Well, the strict father has to punish his children because they will avoid pain and seek pleasure. That is a very quick summary of George Lakoff's strict father. Now, when the children are grown up, father is not in a position to inflict pain on them with quite such impunity. So that's the role of the market. It's kind of a super parent. The market rewards those people who are hardworking, industrious, productive. The strict father morality says that if you have money, that's a sign that you have behaved properly and you have deserved that money. And this is the American dream. You try hard, you can make it. So if you don't make it, by implication, then it's because you're lazy, stupid. You consume more than you produce. And there is some truth in this, in the sense that if you work for 8 hours, you probably get paid about twice as much as if you work 4 hours. Then again, what about people who get paid 100,000 times as much? They don't generally get that by working 400,000 hours. And this is a very influential view in America, perhaps because Americans are, in these terms, the most righteous population. If we look at this map of the world, which is scaled by GDP, then the first point perhaps is that Africa is missing because they have almost negligible GDP. It's very easy to miss. So the strict father model provides a reason why America, at about 5% of the world's population, can consume 25% of the world's produce. Not because it's greedy, they deserve it because they have the money, which they've earned through following the rules of the market. So, according to this public story of money, there are countries where people are educated, hard-working, follow these market rules, and then there are countries where they're just not. Bangladesh is a poor country because there's too many people, they don't produce enough stuff, maybe they're lazy, they're not educated, so they can't compete on the world market. Now, clearly I've got a lot of reservations about this strict father worldview of money, and we'll start with the very basics. This is a quote from J.K. Galbraith. He said,
"The process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled."
Now, I witnessed this, that when describing how banks create money to people, a fairly common response is, well, that couldn't possibly be true. No, that's too simple. Banks can't just type a number into a computer and say, right, now we have the money, it's in your account. They have to get it from somewhere, because this is the universal experience of the users of the money system, as opposed to the super users, those in charge. And yes, the banks are nominally regulated, but the point remains that whilst you can't lend out money you don't have and collect interest on it, banks can, which puts them in a singularly privileged position and creates an obvious logical problem if we assume that the only money you have is money that you deserve and that you've worked hard for. The money that people use is borrowed at interest, and this ensures that, in aggregate, money users are in ever-increasing debt. The only way to get out of debt is to get somebody else into even greater debt. The amount of money in circulation and the amount of debt increase exponentially. So whilst whether or not we have progressive taxes has been a matter of endless debate, in the background we've had this system of interest, which has been going on unchecked in the so-called developed world for centuries, concentrating money in fewer and fewer hands. Can this go on forever? Well, David Graebert, whose debt the first 5,000 years we read on the show, it's available for download as an audiobook, Graeber is quite clear. He says, quote,
"Debt cancellations are to be found again and again in Sumerian and later Babylonian and Assyrian records, and always with the same theme, the restoration of justice and equity."
Unquote. This process has gone on many times and reaches a point where the poor people have nothing to lose. Two things can happen then. Either those who control the system, the super wealthy, have a flash of insight that the whole thing is about to come unstuck and say, right, we'll have a jubilee, cancel the debts, break the tablets. Nowadays, of course, it would be erase the hard drives. We shall go back and redistribute things. If that doesn't happen, then there is a revolution and the debts are cancelled perforce. As David Graeber says,
almost all histories of money continue to begin with fanciful accounts of barter.
And he analyzes in more detail why this is. Why do economists seem to love that story about people carrying around chickens and loaves of bread around the market and then having a brilliant idea that they could use receipts for gold on deposit, carry around small bits of paper instead of goods? Reality is much less clear-cut, to do with the fact that empires needed to pay armies to oppress people, therefore highlights the fact that economics is in no way separate from politics. And wouldn't it be convenient for economists if money actually did arrive from barter? Because compared to a barter system, it's got all these advantages which they love to tell to schoolchildren and economics students, which I think is best understood as a conscious policy to prevent discontent about the status quo. And this is the right point to recall a memory that I had of a film that I saw in primary school in England. Now, I only went to government-run primary school for 2 years, and I remember once sitting in the school hall thinking, but we've already seen this film. Why are they showing us this film again? Because we never got shown films more than once. Except for this one film, which explained, wouldn't you be surprised to hear, how money arose from barter. So, if I saw that film twice in 2 years, I wonder, because I think it was the whole school, may have been subjected to that film. In the UK, it was a policy decision made, every child in primary school, every year, will watch a film to explain how money arose from barter. That is a suspicion. If you have a memory of seeing a film in your early life about money arising from barter, then you can email me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. I wonder if you've had any similar experiences. The next point, morality. When I tell people in Bangladesh that I am British, they say, oh, England, Christian country. I say, well, actually, not a lot of people into Christianity these days. The modern religion is money. And I don't mean that in a flippant sense. For a lot of people, money does decide what's good and bad. It allows them to make sense of their lives. What are they doing? What's their purpose? Their purpose is to collect this powerful magic talisman, which it just so happens a lot of other people are also trying to collect. Having the money to pay for something, does that give you a moral right to it? Well, of course, the person who sells you this, or the institution, are not interested in morals. Almost by definition, in the marketplace, those considerations are set aside. Unless we're going to say, well, morality, that was for my forefathers, I'm not interested in that, I'm a modern, enlightened, it's very easy to add self-interested on there. But if we're going to say, well, no, I'm not interested in morality, then welcome to the world of the market, because the market more or less explicitly says morality doesn't have a place here. It's not quite so clear-cut. Advertisers do try and appeal to people based on morality. These CSR things, they're trying to appeal to people's conscience. Yes, we're offering you a good product at a low price, but they also save the environment. So yes, on a superficial level, some appeal is made to morality. But how many people, if they actually stop to think about that, would believe somebody in that corporation said, we need to do the right thing, not just the thing that makes us the most money? The flip side of the question, if you have no money for something, do you have no entitlement to it? Again, the rules of the market, clear as crystal. If you haven't got the money, no, you're not supposed to have it. How do they explain Africa, hungry people? We're back to the strict father model. They just need to develop, wise up, not be so lazy, embrace GM technologies or other such. If they behave properly, then they would have enough food to eat. That was the story of the market. And through most of my lifetime, I think a lot of people really believed in that. Well, perhaps that's overstating it. It wasn't hard to accept that as a social consensus. I think it's getting harder and harder, and a lot of the frustration of people around the world is that that story is losing its power. People are seeing just what injustices are being perpetrated by the market, and this is very unsettling, because if you take that story away, that definition of what is right and wrong, then how do you know who has an entitlement to what? Yeah, perhaps some people are returning to fundamentalist religion. Problem being now, more than ever, these religions are mixed up. There are Muslims living alongside Christians, living alongside all different other kinds of religions. One of the appeals of free market fundamentalism was that doesn't matter what your cultural background, your religious heritage was, it offered a way to reduce complex decisions to this simple one dimension of money, and if you can do a bit of maths, then suddenly very difficult, multifaceted questions could be easily addressed. Now, I am blessed to work with children, and I ask them, what do you want to do when you grow up? And they want to be a teacher, or a doctor, or an inventor, or a scientist. Why? Because they want to make the world better. And they don't get marks from me because I refuse to give them marks. As we've heard from John Taylor Gatto and others, marks are training for when they get salary. It addicts them to the judgment of others and alienates them from the work that they do. They don't do things in the end for its own sake. As Eisenstein has pointed out recently, this is perhaps why people think of themselves as lazy, because they're not self-motivated. They're trained for the adults who, for example, only a few years after starting medical school with altruistic purposes, or law school, or some other profession, are quickly moulded into self-interested, money-motivated people who are therefore subject to external manipulation and control by those who control the money system. Now, this process of abridging moral decision-making, I think, is a very important one, and one that's not addressed properly by a lot of people who propose so-called alternatives to the money system, including a lot of community currencies. Now, the money system is the product of hundreds or thousands of years of evolution. It's been modified innumerable times by the people who control it. And one of my criticisms of the community currency movement, let schemes and so on, is that whilst they often address some of these points, like the scale, it becomes a more personal system, they don't address this abstraction that one of the most fundamental points of the money system is that it uses money, which is a mathematical construct. And I think in a very important sense, the function of money is to hide its users from the consequences of their actions. If we go back hundreds of years, then it was some kind of genius insight of Adam Smith that you could construct something like an invisible hand, that people who didn't have the ability to communicate as far as prices, supply and demand, but who behaved in a strictly self-interested fashion, could nevertheless, in aggregate, perform any kind of useful function. It's not obvious that that would happen, putting self-interested people together and achieving a net effect, which is, as I shall point out later, not the most efficient solution, but it's also not the least efficient solution. It does happen, overall, that goods moved from places where they were plentiful to places where they were scarce, but where demand was high. How did that happen? People looking at prices, buying low, selling high, and being prepared to be entrepreneurs, to take it between those two points. So that was centuries ago, and money worked to a certain extent to help people coordinate their actions, people acting independently, people without communication, to behave in an even more efficient fashion. I shall make the point later that with the modern technology, we could do things massively more efficiently, and money is no longer a help, it's a hindrance. I wish when I read this, I noted down the details of some European politician. I think it may have been Derek Jensen who quoted the bureaucrat concerned, said something like, agriculture is a fairly irrelevant part of the European economy, because he was looking at a balance sheet and saying, well, yeah, 2%, that's not much, or 5%, or however much it was. He was thinking about the real world through numbers, because it's a great illustration of the fact that you can't reduce the real world to numbers without making it nonsensical. My first thought is, well, you say agriculture is an irrelevant part of what people do in Europe. Let's try living without anybody doing agriculture and see what happens. Of course, it's not an irrelevant part. It may appear as if it's not important on paper, but there's an awful lot more going on than you could possibly express in a balance sheet. We all know this is true, but corporations don't know it's true, to the extent that they're run by people who look at financial summaries, and yes, they have lists of stock and inventories, and they're not only looking at money, but in one sense, everything has to be reduced to money. So yeah, they might have, this takes this much time to produce or to transport. They're not looking at what it actually is. Are we selling guns here, or are we processing watermelons? Everything in the real world is involved in an uncountable number of ways with everything else. If you're growing something, it contributes to the soil fertility. If you're driving a car, you're not just moving something from A to B, you're using up fossil fuels, or you're doing something on the road. So the beauty, the incongruity, the poetry, everything about the real world has to be reduced to money somewhere along the line, or it gets ignored. So if that is the worldview of economics, I'm saying economics is a very, very poor way to understand what's going on in the world. And this is at the heart of my criticism of things like this carbon trading and so on. It's like trying to offer somebody, say, who is tone deaf, a chance to conduct an orchestra, to try and manage what is not a simple thing, what we do in the world, trying to manage that through money. Never mind the fact that money has all these other undesirable properties, but this is something that I think a lot of people who like the idea of community currencies overlook. If we insist on reducing what goes on in the real world into numerical terms, then whilst it's easy to do the math no longer tells us the important things that we need to know. Nowhere is this more acute, as far as I'm concerned, than with that ridiculous question, how much is he worth? Which people continue to ask, as if anybody is worth a certain amount of money. Sort of a King Midas effect. Is there anybody in your life whom you could replace with an amount of money and it would leave things unchanged? Well, of course there isn't. The whole idea is ridiculous, but people do continue to think like that. Why? Because they're part of corporations. They manage things. They know what compensation is. By design, it's an amount of money to make things all right again. Somebody cuts your leg off, but they give you compensation. Are you therefore a whole person again? Of course you're not. No, the real world changes. And there is no amount of money that can make it the same. This is an inevitable effect of saying that we can model a world, we can decide what to do based on numbers. You will get some nonsense results because reality is more complex. Nevertheless, this is what corporations do. If you remember episode 506, Wage Slavery and Moral Dumbing Down, I'm talking about this, the fact that the process of teaching children economic literacy is effectively programming them to do a cost-benefit analysis on everything. By the definition of those who set the curriculum, the cost-benefit analysis is the only acceptable way to make any of these decisions. It also happens to be that way that fits people most easily together, such that they can be controlled by money. Now, maybe you think, well, cost-benefit analysis, nothing wrong with that. Kind of makes sense. You don't want to lose more than you gain, do you? Well, you got to bear in mind that if you do a cost-benefit analysis, maybe there's a decision perhaps you don't particularly want to take, but you might stand to profit financially from it. In fact, any decision, if you can give it a finite cost, I've never heard of people talking about infinite costs in cost-benefit analyses, then there is some amount of money that will motivate you to do this. So this is quite a different beast from most traditional religions, which have rules. Thou shalt not kill. Not a matter of do not kill unless you're paid this much. They're having absolute rules. This is how we organize things. These things must happen, these things must not happen. This is a much more flexible approach, where you may wish to set your own prices, but this still allows you to rationally decide, by their definition of rationality, to do the things that other people with lots of money would like you to do. And the World Bank and the IMF continue to use money as a metric for poverty. And yes, they've modified it, so it's now purchasing power parity. They take into consideration a basket of local items, but they're using money. So we've got somebody who lives self-sufficiently, makes everything he needs or gets given it by neighbours, and gives them things in turn, by definition. If he doesn't have an income, then he is the poorest of the poor. Now, having lots of food, lots of family, good health, you might think these are not signs of poverty. But if you take them away from people, you could get these people out of poverty. Because if you take away their ability to grow food, then they're going to have to buy food. Now they're going to be very motivated to get income. So how are they going to do that? Well, they're not going to be giving things away. If they sell things, then by the terms of the money system, these people are getting richer. Now, I don't know how many people in the development business actually consciously think about this. I rather suspect that just as economics skews people's understanding and is not averse to telling a few convenient lies, such as about how money arose from barter, if the development process and associated education also skews people's understanding to the point where well-intentioned people are being used by less well-intentioned people as a deliberate policy to break up self-sustaining communities. Independent living. Ivan Illich was very vocal, sadly not particularly influential on this 4 decades ago. He called it a war on subsistence. So by definition then, if you can get a cash market to replace an informal gift economy, then you are alleviating poverty. Some of the North American Indians were very keen on gift economy. They had a system called a potlatch, which is basically sort of a massive party where you come and see who can give away the most things to other people. And what did the Christian missionaries do? They said, well, this is illegal. This is just something strange here. I don't know how much that was enforced. I think historians are still debating whether people actually stopped having potlatches. But it shows the attitude. Giving things away, celebrating, enjoying abundance, was something somehow spooky, something so foreign that this was not something that the Western world wanted to deal with. Getting people into the mindset of scarcity, that there were limited amounts of valuable resources and everything should be charged, so much more profitable for those people who can then control the poor suckers who fall for this. I'll be speaking a little bit about economic science, as it used to be called. I've got a bridge to economics, but shows the aspirations of those who set this discipline up. They wanted it to be alongside the natural sciences, physics, chemistry, and so on, ways of describing the real world. And Edgar Fiedler, 20th century economist, said, quote,
"To economists, the real world is often a special case," unquote.
Making the point that there are a lot of theorems, a lot of rules behind these mathematical models, which in reality don't actually explain what's going on. Doesn't stop people from writing books about these theorems, doesn't stop people from researching, making ever more complicated models, the fact that reality is somewhere else. Now, obviously, if economics was a real science, it would look at the world and try to understand it, rather than having its own models and giving preference to that, then trying to make the world fit those models by having things such as campaigns to train schoolchildren that money derived from barter, or that they should be economically literate and do cost-benefit analyses on everything. This picture of the Tower of Pisa is my summary of modern economics, what you need to know. We have a lot of complicated theory, some very clever maths on the top. On the bottom, what do we have? Homo economicus, money, prices, representing the real world with a one-dimensional abstraction, representing the complexity of human beings, Homo sapiens, with a one-dimensional replica, Homo economicus. The traditional economic theory is based on some foundations which are known to be rubbish. People are assumed to be completely informed on all the prices and the quality of all of the things they could buy. We know this is nonsense. They're rational. Again, they're not rational in that mathematical sense, the very precise sense that economists assume. People are assumed to be completely lazy. They'll never do things unless they get paid. They're assumed to be completely selfish and never to think about other people's welfare. They're assumed to be completely greedy, always wanting more. And amoral, that's a big one. So they have no morals, no other values, no motivation to do anything except for maximizing their utility, according to this very narrow model. On my first economics lecture at university, the lecturer went through these, as you tend to, rather briefly, with first-year students. Okay, we accept that. Let's assume there's only two products. We've got more in the real world, but we only got two-dimensional graphs, so we'll draw them out like this. Okay, makes sense. Let's assume people are like this. They don't care about other people. Okay, so alarm bells are ringing in my head at that point. Are we happy with this? Now, one of those fateful decisions, I kind of wanted to put my hand up and say, no, I'm not happy. But also, in my first lecture at economics, I thought I'd want to make a fool of myself. Nevertheless, I somehow got it together and said, no, I am not happy. Why would I assume something that I know is wrong, considering I do have friends and I do care about them? Lecturer was rather taken aback. I'm not sure this had happened to him before. And the best he could manage was, well, if we don't assume this, then we can't do economics. Which, you know, having made my point, I said, all right, I didn't need to pass that course in order to get the whole degree. So I piped down. Well, that was for 10 years. Approximately a decade later, I realized what he would have been more honest if he'd said is, we can't do this form of economics. And thereby hangs the tale of how I got started on a replacement economic theory, altruistic economics, which doesn't assume that people are selfish maximizers and that they're not interested in anybody else's welfare. In fact, it assumes people have a set of people whose welfare is important to them. If you're interested to know more about the theory I came up with, then you can look at altruists.org/AE. Don't be put off that it calls itself altruistic economics. Hasn't got a lot to do with traditional economic theory, so it doesn't, for example, have money. Economists love to talk about the invisible hand of their market, how balanced things are, how if you've got a shortage of something, then you're motivating people to find substitutes and so on. You've got to look quite carefully, and you've got to have at least half a foot outside of economics in the real world to see what this entails. If we look at how they use money to reconcile supply and demand, you've got these mathematical equations and curves. You don't need to study the theory to understand. If you've got prices, you've got supply, you've got demand, where do you fit if you don't have any money? You don't fit anywhere into this world of the economists. Are there people who don't have money? Yet quite a lot, actually, in the real world. What do economists have to say about these people? For example, hungry people in Africa? Well, they have no effective demands. Economists are often not this quick to admit that their system doesn't work. It's back to this case of the real world being a special case, that yes, there are people who don't have effective demand. They certainly have a demand for food. We all have a demand for food, but because they don't have these magic beans, which are deliberately scarce anyway, then their demands are not effective, so they don't get met by supply. So this wonderful thing about supply and demand only makes sense in the world of the economist. In the real world, it doesn't match supply and demand, and this explains why, rather than growing food for people in Africa, farmers are rewarded for growing flowers and exporting them to Europe, where people have got more of these magic beans. So their wishes for flowers are given priority over the wishes of the Africans for food. Now, if you put it to people, would you rather have flowers or would you rather have African people eating food? I think a lot of those flower consumers would rethink and say, that's not fair. But because they're in the market, they're thinking like economists, they've been trained, they never frame it in those terms. Because they're expressing themselves through money, they're buying things, we've all had this experience. If we've used money, you tend to look for getting the best product at the lowest price. There is this doctrine, the invisible hand, that we should all behave like that, and that somehow things will work out. Now we're back to the strict father. If you do something like giving charity, you're breaking the system. You're motivating these people to stay lazy. So there's an answer for it. No, things won't work if you're compassionate. What you should be is completely selfish. Now, I'm glad I never became an economist. I never got trapped in that worldview. For about a decade after meeting economics at university, I thought, well, this is clearly nonsense. This is not related to the real world, and I don't want to fill my head with it. Then I thought, well, if I go to a foreign country, I do make a point of trying to understand some of the local language, because I want to communicate with people. I want to be able to listen what's going on. And I thought, in the same sense, if I want to communicate with economists and people who've been trained to think in that way, I need to learn what they think is important, what they've been taught. And hats off to an anonymous financial insider called Smithy.
And a set of 22 podcasts made for this program entitled Wizards of Money.
I highly recommend it. It's what got me started on questioning the money system. and they're all available for download from this website. Or if you just go to Google and you type Wizards of Money, back to 2003, and Smithy's podcasts had got me interested in economics enough to read about price discrimination. So here's a challenge for you. If you're Intel, you're making CPUs, there's not a lot of competition. Not many other companies making comparable products. And you have about the best CPU on the market, 486DX, a fast chip with a math coprocessor. How can you improve your sale value of the chips that you've got? I'll give you a clue. You need to use some electricity at a high voltage. Well, I think the chances are high. You're probably scratching your head thinking, what is Robin going on about here? Because it didn't occur to me until I read that this is how they made 486SXs, which is a slightly damaged but still working CPU, that they could actually increase the sale value of their product by damaging it. What do I mean? Well, they have a kind of a problem of setting the price. If they set the price high, then yes, they get a lot of revenue from a small number of people who have that much money to spend and are that keen to get a good CPU. If they set the price low, then they're going to have more people buy it, but they won't get so much profit. What they would really like to do is to sell it for a high price to people who are very keen to buy it, and to sell the chip for a lower price to people who are not so keen to buy it, because then you could increase the market share and you're getting some of the surplus, you're getting the high price from people who are desperate to have it. So, does that help you see what to do to maximize your profit if you've got a stockpile of the best CPUs? You can partially damage the chip. You can blow the maths coprocessor. Put too many volts through that little piece of the chip. That becomes inoperational. And now you've got two products. A fully functional product and a less functional product. So, you can sell the fully functional product for a high price to people with lots of money who really want a fully functional product. And you can sell the less functional product to people who want the chip but don't want it as badly. People who wouldn't buy it at the higher price. So that's what Intel did. And did this behavior stop with the end of the 486 chip? No. Intel are making multi-core processors. And sometimes they blow one of the processors, so they have a less functional product that they can sell for less money to capture the poor end of the market. Is it confined to CPUs? Absolutely not. There are lots of products out there which are deliberately dysfunctional because it makes the company more money to sell dysfunctional products than to sell fully functional products. So this is 2003, about 4 years after I got a PhD in mathematics, and I thought, well, this is rather fascinating stuff. We have a system here which rewards people for damaging their own property before they've sold it to anybody. Never mind people who talk about, oh, we need to have a system to stop companies externalizing their costs. You know, they're damaging the environment and then they don't pick up the tab. Well, there is something important going on there, definitely. But if we corrected for that, if we did manage somehow to cost the infinitely complex environment by putting a sequence of numbers and formulae on it, are we going to say this aspect that people are rewarded for damaging their own product? Are we going to accept that and say, well, that's just how the world is? As a mathematician, I thought, this is crazy. If we can't tackle this, we have to expect problems. So I set it as a challenge for myself. What would a system be like which didn't motivate people to destroy their own property, to damage their own goods? And to cut a long story short, I came up with altruistic economics. A system in which Intel would declare this is how much it cost us to make the chip, and the users would declare this is how much value it is to me. Now, people's instinctive reaction is, oh, well, that wouldn't work because people would try and cheat. which is an instance of a wider problem that people's behaviour has been twisted by the current system. I'm not saying nobody would try to cheat. I'm sure some people would. But we have a system which rewards people for trying to cheat at the moment. Why do people try to cheat a lot? The system says this is how you should behave. In the words of Abraham Maslow, 20th century psychologist, quote, "Classical economic theory, based as it is on an inadequate theory of human motivation, could be revolutionized by accepting the reality of higher human needs, including the impulse to self-actualization and the love for the highest values." Unquote. Now, what could this mean? How about a system that fed you and housed you and trusted that because you'd been looked after, you would in turn want to do the same to other people, to the next generation? A lot of societies seem to have managed this quite successfully. I'm trying to make the point that because money assumes the worst of people, it doesn't bring out their best in them. So we've seen the model of Homo economicus, very unflattering, and we've got to think about psychopaths, people born without a conscience, as far as we know. There's no therapy, no medical procedure to give these people a conscience, and not having an awareness of how they somehow should behave, then they tend to feel no guilt, behave extremely, utterly selfishly, very good at lying because they don't get any pangs of guilt. So these people tend to live parasitic lifestyles, and in my interpretation, because they don't love other people, they can't fully understand other people as independent, feeling people, then they feel very, very insecure, and because they can't imagine other people could love them. How does this manifest itself? They tend to ruthlessly seek power over other people. And money, I claim, facilitates such a life of parasitism. How? Because if you're very selfish, guiltless, this is, in economic terms, rational. This tendency for self-aggrandizement at the expense of everybody and everything else has manifested itself in economic theory. And we're going to hear a quote in a little while from a 19th century economist, Frédéric Bastiat, who points at how it could be more than just a coincidence that the economic model basically assumes that people will behave as psychopaths. So anybody deviating from that is stigmatized, punished, told in more or less direct fashion that they should behave psychopathically or sociopathically. I use the word sociopath for people born with a conscience, but who have learnt to behave as if they had no conscience. And my claim is that money facilitates such a life of parasitism. Think about people with large amounts of wealth. Does anybody ask them, where did you get that wealth? By and large, that's not how money works. You take the money and you don't ask questions. So how does money affect people psychologically? From a very early age, you learn that if you have money and you give it to somebody else, the more they gain from you, the more you have to lose. Not being a bank yourself, you can't create money out of nothing. So there is only a fixed amount to go around. Now, you might think, well, that's obvious. That's just how anything works. But of course, first of all, it doesn't apply to things like MP3s. It doesn't apply to feelings. Making somebody happy doesn't make you sad. Making somebody laugh probably makes more people laugh. So it's not the case that everything works like that. Now, if you think, well, services, if you know how to do something, no skin off your nose, you don't lose out by telling somebody else how to do something. Except you do in the money system. If you have a rare skill and you share it around, it becomes a common skill. I'm suggesting that money naturalizes competition, and you learn very quickly growing up in, say, a developed society, how important money seems to be and how nobody ever seems to quite have enough. So being selfish for money would seem like common sense. I don't mean this just in narrow financial terms. I mean, I think there is a generalized anxiety related to money and security, and because there is more debt out there than there is capital to repay it, it's very widespread in the moneyed world. Now, as an illustration of how I intend this to be understood in a larger sense, last week I gave an assignment to my class to write about what practical things they could do now to improve the world. Now, a large number of them wrote about giving money to charity. And that was interesting in and of itself, because I didn't specify that they had to use money. How did they get that impression? Well, there's a big emphasis on being charitable in the narrow financial sense. I mean, in Britain, it goes so far as authorities and other organizations are putting up posters saying, do not give money to beggars. They'll spend it on alcohol or something else that they shouldn't be spending it on. Give it to us instead. We'll give it to them in a responsible way. So person-to-person charity without an organization in the middle is increasingly frowned upon. It's not yet illegal. But to get back to the children, quite a lot of them talked about recycling and said we should recycle. And I think it's Annie Leonard from The Story of Stuff talks about the ratio of industrial to domestic waste as something huge. It's about 60 or 70 to 1. So if you perfectly sorted your waste, it actually wouldn't make a great deal of difference, because higher upstream, where you never even see this, there's a tremendous amount of pollution and so on going on. And I mention that not only because a lot of my children picked up on that. They're not adults. They're heavily influenced by media. But I mention it because I think a lot of people, when it comes to how do I improve the world, think about, well, I should be buying fluorescent light bulbs instead of incandescent ones. Their imagination of what changes are possible has been very limited by commercially controlled media, by those people who control the money system, who want people never to even imagine that there is anything beyond it or outside it, that its very fundamental parameters could be changed. So, apart from giving money to charity and recycling their trash, what was the other key couple of points that I picked up from my students? Well, there was two. One was that everybody seemed to assume that the world was separate from them, so it wasn't about making their lives better. It wasn't about smiling at their mum or their friends. It was always strangers out there. And the other point was that it had to involve them suffering, which wasn't my intention at all, because I'm thinking, let's find some things that are worth doing, get on and do it. And why is that? I think it might have been this, especially because they talked a lot about giving money to charity. How do you help somebody through money? You give them money, and the more you give them, the more you lose out. So even when they were thinking about other ways of helping, they perceived that the gain of the rest of the world had to be their loss. So this is what I mean by saying the zero sum goes deeper than just when they think about money. I wonder if we'd ask the same question to a group of kids not in a heavily monetized society, how could you practically improve the world? I think they might say things like, well, we could plant some trees, or we could build a bridge, or we could do something that would make everybody's lives better. Rather than thinking the only way I have to help other people would harm me, which, if you actually believe that, is quite a motivation to not help other people. And, I mean, this is kids who haven't even been brainwashed in economic literacy. So that's quite a broad argument, but I think an important one. So let's look at specifics. This is a paper called The Symbolic Power of Money: Reminders of Money Alter Social Distress and Physical Pain, published in 2009, where the researchers looked at people who counted money and then put their hands in hot water and rated the pain. And the control group rated the pain from 0 to 10, how hot is this water, after not counting money, but counting similarly shaped pieces of paper. And people who counted money felt slightly less pain than the people who were counting the paper. Why is that? The researchers suggest, and this finding didn't come as a surprise, that when you think about money, it makes you feel strong, resilient, insensitive to pain. I mean, they weren't paying people to put their hands in hot water. They were just counting paper, counting this money, then doing it. And that marginal exposure, nobody got that money, just being reminded of it, made people less sensitive to their own body. So if it makes you less sensitive to your own pain, I think it's not a leap of imagination that reminders of money, say you're doing a business deal, will make you less sensitive to the pain, the welfare, the suffering of other people. And the second point, they looked at social isolation. Basically, they cheated to these people and made these people feel like nobody wanted to be friends with them. Then looked at the same effect, and it was dramatically heightened. Now, does this describe the lives of people you know? People whose security is in money. They don't have a rich social life. They don't have a lot of people who know them, love them, care about them. But their anesthetic, their way of getting through the day, is to think, well, look how much money we made today. We can trust in this money to look after us. Then this is a strong motivation for those people to try and keep the show on the road. And they are, after all, people with the most money are the people who control the media, politics, government, all these large organizations. And, yeah, beneath them in these hierarchies are people who feel like their life, their standing, depends on it. So to look at the next experiment I'm going to talk about, A Fine is a Price. This is from 2000. It was carried out in 1998, a famous experiment involving people who turn up late to pick up their children from kindergarten. The researchers picked 6 out of the 10 kindergartens they studied and said, we're going to introduce a system of fines. If you're late, you've got to pay this much money. And if you're an economist, you think, well, they didn't have to pay anything before. It's getting financially more difficult for them to be late, so they're going to turn up on time more. And of course, that's not what happened. More people turned up late when the fine system was introduced. Well, the researchers said, a fine is a price. If you're going to pay money for being late, you don't have to feel bad about being late. You say, look, I've done my bit. You've got your money. Now I'm going to turn up late if I want to. So in other words, moving it into the financial world meant that people didn't have to think about other people. So that was the first step. Then when they said, okay, now we're going to try what happens if we don't have a fine. So if you're an economist, you think, well, whatever strange behavior people had, that should go back to what it was before. No, it didn't go back. People's lateness was about the same as it was when they were being fined, i.e. it was later. So the point here is, monetizing things changes attitudes. I think a lot of economists would concede that money has a powerful influence over society, and because human beings are complicated and social structures are not, I mean, the economists don't even try and model these things. They generally have a very crude set of variables in their macroeconomic models. So economists will probably be ready to agree, I think, yes, money is a complex thing, and experiments like this show that it is hard to predict. But I think the point is fairly clear. If the use of money makes people behave more selfishly and rewards those who do so, then increasing the amount of times that people think about money is going to have deleterious effects on society. So is this related to the fact that more American adults now live alone than live as married couples? Well, that too, certainly a very complicated issue, but the basic point is that money disconnects its users from each other. Charles Eisenstein found this when he wrote in A Scent of Humanity about his experience trying to create a community in America. People who lived right next to each other felt that they didn't need each other. Why? Because they had this anonymous power, money, which could get things done for them. So, as they say, he who pays the piper calls the tune. Money legitimizes control relationships. When we see this through the eyes of the strict father model, it seems that that's just the way things should be. If you are rich, therefore more virtuous, then you should be making more of the decisions than the lazy, the indisciplined poor. So how does this fit in terms of corporations, where most people work? Well, we know what a corporation is. It's a large number of people in a multi-leveled hierarchy with very few people at the top. How do you get to the top of one of these organizations? Is it by having an active conscience, thinking about the world around you? Well, no, that might make you a popular person in a limited community, but more or less, there's something like a meritocracy where merit is very narrowly defined as the ability to make money. I haven't studied business studies. I tend to think this is what it comes down to, training people to do exactly what they're told and come up with different ways of maximizing the income of that corporation. So, firstly, if you're a normal person with a conscience and you see a lot of other people getting promoted, then it motivates you to do the same thing. Because we have this idea that that's a successful thing. These are somehow smart people that should be emulated. So that's the first point. For normal people, it makes them more sociopathic. So what about if you're one of these 1% of people without a conscience? Well, it's never difficult to put yourself first because no one else is of importance. And if that means working to create money for the corporation, then you're ready to do that. So in practical terms, I think a large proportion of the leadership are psychopathic or at least sociopathic. As an example of what this leads to, remember the Ford Pinto. Rear collisions with the Ford Pinto above 30 miles an hour tend to explode the gas tank and jam the doors, so if you're a passenger in such a collision, you're likely to get burnt to death or severely injured. Ford knew this, but didn't stop releasing the car because, like proper business people, had been trained to do a cost analysis and said, look, $6 per car is going to be a lot of money to fix the cars. We've got to do this thing on all our production, whereas there's not going to be that many accidents. So $200,000 per victim is what they reckoned out. Overall, the analysis said we're better off having some victims. So it was more cost effective to produce defective cars. They weren't making the best cars they could make. They were focused on the money. And they had a lot of documents making it quite clear that they had done exactly this cost analysis. And legal action was taken, and it was ineffective because they weren't doing anything wrong according to what companies are supposed to do. Now, if I decided that it was more cost-effective for me to kill somebody and I measured it out as an individual, but that doesn't get me off the hook of murder, but apparently it did in this case, and that's quite a precedent to set. So, to summarise on the social effect, more money comes into society, the less its members care about one another, the more they get arranged in these competitive hierarchical relationships, in which, when money is involved in this corporate relationship, even the laws of the country are up for grabs. It's illustrated succinctly here with a quote, Franklin Roosevelt writing to Colonel House in 1933, candidly, quote,
"The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centres has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson." Unquote.
So, it would be wrong to expect a lot from these organizations to check the power of money, rather the reverse, as we witnessed by the complete failure to bring people to book for these fairly obvious and pretty massive financial crimes. We have the broad phenomenon of regulatory capture, the very organs of government and law which on paper have the power to regulate business seem incapable of doing so. In fact, as we heard in episode 572, Monopoly and Money, these supposedly regulatory agencies end up as tools of the corporations to prevent competition and preserve the dominant market dynamic. And examples include the self-styled mainstream media, that is, the commercially controlled media. It's had a huge consolidation process and specializes in spreading lies at the behest of corporations or other such powerful institutions as, for example, the US Defense Department, and the fact that they lost 25% of the money that they'd been given, announced on Monday the 10th of September 2001. I think the most powerful of all the arguments that the money system cannot continue is the ecological one. To quote from Aldous Huxley,
quote,
"The prosperity we've known up to the present is the consequence of rapidly spending the planet's irreplaceable capital."
Unquote.
Yeah, if this seems to be a new phenomenon, I think it's just the fact that the pace of destruction has accelerated. I'm reminded of a quote from the North American Indians.
Quote,
"Only when the last tree has died and the last river has been poisoned and the last fish has been caught, will we realize that we cannot eat money."
Unquote.